Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning and welcome to the oral argument in this case, which is Hayes versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections, case number 19-10856. Judge Newsom, Judge Chopra, and I are very happy to have you with us. This case was originally scheduled for argument in March, but was moved until a later day, and that later day is today. So Mr. Robinson is going to let you know when you have 2 minutes left for your initial argument, and other than that, we're ready to proceed. So Ms. Koch, we're ready to hear from you.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. I am Assistant Attorney General Donna Koch, representing the Florida Department of Corrections this morning. The district court erred in two major ways in granting Mr. Hayes habeas corpus relief. The district court failed to accord AEDPA deference to the state court's ruling, which found trial counsel had not performed efficiently when he withdrew the insanity defense before trial. Additionally, in its de novo review of Mr. Hayes' Strickland claims, the district court relieved Mr. Hayes from his affirmative burden to establish the Strickland claims and instead fashioned an entirely new basis upon which to find trial counsel deficient, which was a failure to prepare an insanity defense. Now, the district court actually cited Prophet versus Waldron, a Fifth Circuit failure to investigate case. So it's clear that that was the basis upon which the district court did grant relief. Pardon me, this morning my voice is a bit weak. Now, I understand this court has read the brief and therefore, maybe even twice, and therefore is aware of the facts and arguments for reversal. So given that, I would like to highlight for the court this morning certain documents in the record which may aid the court in its decision in this case.
Could I ask you, before you start that, so I don't interrupt you during that presentation, could I ask you a question, please?
Of course, Your Honor.
My question is this. Is there any evidence or testimony in the record that Mr. Hayes' trial counsel had Mr. Hayes examined by any sort of medical expert with regards to whether or not he was sane or insane at the time of the murder in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll be happy to answer that question. Back in January 2003, which would have been 1 year after the crime was committed, and, oh, I would say 9 months after trial counsel had assumed the representation, he filed a motion with the court, Judge Perry, and in the motion he states that undersigned counsel has reasonable grounds to believe the defendant may have been insane at the time of the offense charged against the defendant, and in that motion asked the court to appoint an expert to assist undersigned counsel and order the findings of the expert to be reviewed. This was page 36 of the record. It was signed by trial counsel. So the court indeed does find an expert, and it's Dr. Gamache. Dr. Gamache's evaluation, which took place just a couple of months later in 2003, sets forth that in the very first paragraph that he was asked to evaluate Mr. Hayes to help determine any defenses that are possible in the case. But what happens, and Dr. Gamache sets this forth clearly in this letter, and it's part of the record. Dr. Gamache says that Mr. Hayes refused to talk to him, despite repeated attempts to get to be able to evaluate Mr. Hayes at the court, at counsel's request and at the court's motion. And so Dr. Gamache cannot make an evaluation as far as insanity at the time of the crime, because Mr. Hayes would not cooperate. And so trial counsel made an effort. He definitely made that effort. What is also important for the court to consider, and I hope this helps satisfies your honor's question. It's a very important question. Mr. Trial counsel assumed the representation of Mr. Hayes within 3 months of Mr. Hayes committing this crime. So trial counsel actually was trial counsel for 3 years from the beginning, essentially, aside from 3 months, through the trial. So this was the same trial counsel, and frankly, it was the same judge. Judge Perry was the judge throughout the entire 3 years. Within a month or two of trial counsel assuming the representation, he files a motion with the court and says he would like to have medical experts, psychological experts, appointed to evaluate Mr. Hayes. And one of the highlights that I would like to bring to the court's attention this morning is one of the psychological experts appointed was Dr. Sidney Marin. Now, Dr. Sidney Marin's evaluation is important for a couple of reasons. Now, in the reply brief, I set forth Dr. Marin's, pretty much his entire evaluation, because it's all very important. But to answer your honor's question, and then I'll get back to where I'd like to quote, what Dr. Marin does at the conclusion of this evaluation, he notes that while he was not completely asked to evaluate Mr. Hayes' mental state at the time of the crime, he went ahead and did so anyway. And he made a finding that Mr. Hayes was competent at the time and date of the attempted first-degree murder. So in the record...
You said that he was... The conclusion was that he was competent or that he was sane. Those are two different mental states.
You're completely correct, Your Honor, and he does use the word competent. But if I may read that paragraph to you, it may insinuate what he was actually trying to do. I have quoted it on page 12 of my reply brief.
You don't have to read it. I don't want to interrupt your argument, and you've given me the answers that I was looking for.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Your Honor, thank you. Now, what is within Dr. Marin's evaluation, and it is quoted on page 11. In the first full paragraph, Dr. Marin sets forth, quote, "The defendant denied the charge of attempted first-degree murder." And then he talks about why the police fingered him. It was his parents turned him in. But then in the next full paragraph, the cousins and the uncle had been called to the home the next day to talk with Mr. Hayes. And the uncle, this is set forth, I'm paraphrasing at this point, the uncle had advised the defendant he could be sentenced to death if the victim would expire. And now I will quote, "Following that comment, Damien stated the victim was in fact not killed, according to his information. In response to questions concerning this, Damien stated a homicide detective had shown the victim the defendant's picture, with the victim indicating that picture was not of her assailant. When I, and that's Dr. Merritt, when I then asked why he was arrested, Damien stated he had been told the authorities had found blood in his sink. Damien then added, to this point, he has seen no evidence of his complicity in the crime. That's significant because it gives insight into what Mr. Hayes was thinking when he said that he denied the charge. The second document I would like to highlight for this court's consideration is quoted in the district court's order, actually. It's this
2 minutes office. Remaining.
What, excuse me? 2 minutes?
2 minutes remaining, yes.
Oh, good gravy. Okay, I'm sorry. It's this August 19th letter that is quoted in full in the court's order. And in that letter, he actually, Mr. Cannella notes that initially Mr. Hayes wanted to plead guilty to maybe with not get a life sentence on the first-degree murder charge. And what this letter shows is that Mr. Hayes changes his mind. He initially was going to plead guilty to that charge along with the battery charge, but he changes his mind and tells Mr. Cannella that he now wants to plead guilty to only the battery charge, but he, quote, wants to plead innocent to the murder charge. So right from early in the representation, within 7 months, Mr. Cannella, trial counsel, has now heard that Mr. Hayes wants to plead innocent, is what the word is used here, but clearly not guilty. So that's what trial counsel was operating on through the remainder of the representation. On February 17th, why that transcript is also important is because within that transcript, Judge Perry found that Mr. Hayes was competent to proceed to trial. That is only 5 days before the trial happened in this case. So when you fast forward to the on the record conversation, which actually took place on February 21st, not
counsel,
February.
Your time has expired.
You can
finish up. Go ahead and finish up your thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. Why this February 21st transcript is very important. Not only does it show that trial counsel was simply mistaken about the date of the 17th, but after they have the discussion on the record about Mr. Hayes wanting to plead not guilty, this is what Mr. Cannella says to Judge Perry. He says, I won't quote the whole thing due to time. He says to the judge, it is now clear to me that his answers in his meeting, Mr. Hayes, answers to my questions here on the record this morning indicate that he does not want to proceed with that defense. He's talking about insanity. Therefore, I feel I have no alternative but to withdraw the notice of intention to rely upon the defense of insanity. We know under applicable case law, a trial counsel cannot force his client to plead guilty. And that's what Mr. Cannella, that's what trial counsel believed. And I could talk on more, but I have exceeded my time. If the court doesn't have any questions, I will wait for rebuttal.
Yes, you've got your full 3 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, this is William Pinnell, and I represent the appellee, Damien Hayes, in this case.
Good morning.
It's our position that the district court properly concluded that Mr. Hayes was provided ineffective assistance to counsel because trial counsel's decision to abandon the insanity defense 6 days prior to trial was unreasonable under the circumstances of this case.
Mr. Cornell, can I ask you a question as well? And my question is directed toward the prejudice prong of Strickland.
Sure.
There is a Supreme Court case called Knowles versus Meyerzant. It's from 2009, and it involves a lawyer's advice to his counsel, advice to his client about proceeding with a not guilty by reason of insanity theory. In that case, the Supreme Court has alternative rulings. It applies AEDPA deference in the first part of the opinion, and then it does something which it doesn't often do. It goes through an alternative de novo review of the ineffectiveness claim. With regards to prejudice under de novo review, the court says that with regard to prejudice, the petitioner in that case has to show that there is a reasonable probability that he would have prevailed on his insanity defense had he pursued it. Do you think that same standard applies here, that Mr. Hayes has to show on the prejudice side that had his counsel proceeded with an insanity defense, there is a reasonable probability that a jury would have found him insane at the time of the offense?
I think that generally that the Strickland standard applies here, and I think it's important to realize, not your honors, but I think some judges and some lawyers overstate the burden to show prejudice. The burden to show a reasonable probability is just to show that the deficient performance undermines confidence in the outcome. And Strickland says, even if it cannot be shown by a preponderance of the evidence to have determined the outcome. So it doesn't have to be proven by 51% or even 50%. And I think Lockhart versus Fretwell and Tejavov versus Dubois are important because they talk about whether the trial or the proceedings were fundamentally fair. And in the Dubois case, the court came to the conclusion where the trial counsel abandoned the only viable defense. It's impossible to conclude that the proceedings are reliable.
I don't disagree with how you framed the reasonable probability standard, but here it looks like the district court didn't even try to apply that standard.
I respectfully disagree. On page at the end of the court's opinion, I believe they cite the Dubois case and the Walker case and talk about fundamental fairness and how a trial is not fundamentally fair when the only viable defense is abandoned by trial counsel. I want to make sure I quote it correctly. So this is on page 37 of the district court's decision, and the court concludes that counsel's decision to abandon the only viable defense, and I added the word viable defense because that was discussed in the preceding sentence, prejudiced Mr. Hayes, and cites Tejada and Lockhart versus Fretwell talking about a fundamentally unfair or unreliable proceeding, and also cites the Walker case.
Here's the way I'm trying to think about the prejudice issue a little more abstractly. If your only viable defense is an insanity defense, but you don't have any evidence whatsoever to support it, the withdrawal of that defense can't constitute prejudice, right?
I would agree with that. But here there's significant evidence that would support the insanity defense. Trial counsel testified repeatedly at the evidentiary hearing that he had at least one of the experts he had consulted that Mr. Hayes may have been insane at the time of the offense. There was a significant history of mental health issues laid out in the exhibits introduced at the evidentiary hearing, and there was also from various experts, and there was also lay testimony from his father that was included in one of the experts' reports that talked about the conduct of the defendant 6 months before the incident, which was pretty substantial in terms of how he was acting mentally ill. So it's our position that I would certainly agree if there was no evidence to support an insanity defense, Mr. Hayes could not show prejudice, but I don't think that's the record here.
Okay, this is
all right. Thank you very much for the answer. I appreciate it.
So this is Judge Newsom. Can I ask you what, to my mind, may be an antecedent question? So at page, 34 of the 37-page order, the district court announces that it's going to apply de novo review. And it does so on the basis that it had found that the state court unreasonably determined the facts. How do we get there? How can we conclude that the state court here unreasonably determined the facts with respect to whether trial counsel had this discussion with your client?
So
he testified on the stand that he did, right? At the state post-conviction hearing, he testified on the stand that he did.
His testimony was conflicting at best. I think that certainly, as a general matter, a federal habeas court has the obligation to defer to state court findings and certainly can't second-guess credibility determinations that are based on demeanor or a trial judge's ability to observe the testimony of a witness. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is, and this is informed by this court's decision in Jones, footnote 5, which I think is important. In that case, they found that the habeas court properly applied the NOVA review and found that the fact-finding of the state court was unreasonable when the Georgia Supreme Court found that a witness had testified about warning the defendant about the dangers of self-representation. When the federal habeas court then reviewed the transcript, that the record did not bear that out. So what we have here is the same thing. Mr. Cannella, the trial counsel, was specifically asked at the evidentiary hearing whether ever had recalled having a specific conversation with Hayes. Mr. Hayes explained that he could be found not guilty on either a straight not guilty plea or a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. And he responded that he did not believe that explanation was contained. He responded he did not recall having the conversation in that respect, but also that the explanation was contained in his letter to Mr. Hayes. When the letter was read into evidence, there was no mention of the term insanity at all. So, and then he testified that quote, he did not remember having a discussion with Mr. Hayes in which he explained the difference between a straight not guilty and an offense of not guilty. So I think the district court in this case properly found that the fact-finding of the state courts was unreasonable and then applied to the NOVA review that this court applied in Jones.
The reason I ask is that it seems to me, just in reading the district court's opinion, that the district court became sort of fixated on the absence of this transcript of February 21 and sort of absent proof that this absent sort of record proof that this colloquy occurred. The district court was just bound and determined to conclude that this was an unreasonable determination of the facts. And it just strikes me as nearly a logical error to say that the absence of smoking gun evidence that Mr. Cannella was telling the truth, the district court seemed to conclude, is evidence that he was lying. And those are just, I just think they're two different things. With or without the transcript, even before you even get to the post-conviction hearing, you know, even at trial, I think if I'm recalling the chronology correctly, on February 24th, the lawyer said to the trial judge, you'll remember a few days ago, I had this colloquy in front of Your Honor, and it turns out he had the date wrong. He said February 17th, and he must have meant February 21. But in any event, I mean, so, and then at the post-conviction hearing, I agree with you that it's not sort of as clear as one might hope. But it just seems like from the totality of the evidence that the state court at the very least reasonably could have concluded that the lawyer, Mr. Cannella, had this conversation. And I'm just not quite sure.
Your Honor,
it seems like you've got to have a pretty good firm basis for upsetting that finding.
I certainly agree with the last part, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree with the earlier conclusion. I think Mr. Cannella makes a general statement that he had this conversation and explained the difference between not guilty and straight not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity. But when pressed to give details, every single example he gives when that conversation occurred is not borne out by the record. First, we have the letter where there's no discussion of the insanity, and each and every hearing that he cites, there's no clear indication that Mr. Hayes understands that you can be not guilty by reason of insanity. Even the missing transcript, February 21st, which we don't think this court should consider because it wasn't considered by the state court, even in that transcript, the defendant merely says he just wants to plead not guilty, not that he understands that he can be not guilty by reason of insanity, and there's no actual explanation from counsel on the record explaining the difference or explaining that you can be found not guilty by reason of insanity. So I hear what you're saying, but I think every single example trial counsel gives of explaining the difference or having this conversation is then actually refuted by the actual record. So I think the district court made the right conclusion that it was an unreasonable factual determination. You know, it's similar to what this court found in Jones, where if a witness says, if a state court finds that a lawyer testified to a certain fact, and then you go to the transcript and the transcript doesn't bear that out, then it's an unreasonable factual determination. I think it's the same here. So I'd ask the court to look at footnote 5 of the Jones decision, and I think that's why the district court in this case properly applied the de novo standard review and properly concluded that there was an unreasonable determination of the facts in this case.
I'm going to look at Jones. Are you familiar with this case? I don't know that it was cited in the briefs, and maybe I'm mispronouncing it, called Nejad, Nejad, versus the Attorney General of the State of Georgia.
I don't believe I'm familiar with that one.
So I'll look at Jones, and you can look at this one. It's 830 F. 3rd, 1280. And that one, frankly, seems to set up pretty much like this case as well, where the question was whether – and I'm going to give you some time to run over your time. I think Judge Jordan will, because I'm gobbling up your time here. But the question there was whether the habeas petitioner, he was bringing an ineffective assistance claim based on his counsel's alleged failure to advise him about that he had the right not to testify. The state said that the colloquy occurred at trial. The defendant said it didn't. The state habeas court found the lawyer credible. Federal district court says it's an unreasonable determination of the facts, grants the writ, and we reverse. And we basically say the fact that there's no sort of smoking gun evidence on the record that this discussion occurred doesn't mean it didn't occur.
Okay. My response would be that trial counsel gave repeated indications of where he had this discussion, and every time you look at those individual instances, that discussion did not occur. So, and then he gave affirmative testimony that he never had the discussion with him in that manner. He never explained the difference between not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity. So he gave affirmative testimony that he didn't give the advice that he claims to have given. So I think his own testimony undoes his initial reference that he did give that advice. But more importantly, I think that whether he gave that advice or not under the U.S. Supreme Court's decision and Nixon and its progeny, I think that trial counsel has a duty to act reasonably here, and the defendant doesn't have the ability to dictate strategy or tactics to get a not guilty, because you can get a not guilty by a straight not guilty or a not guilty by reason of insanity. If trial counsel, it's our position that the only reasonable strategy in this case was to seek not guilty by reason of insanity, based on the evidence, strong evidence against Mr. Hayes and the strong evidence of his mental health history. So regardless of whether he had the conversation with Mr. Hayes, which we believe the record does not bear out, trial counsel acted unreasonably by withdrawing the defense of insanity under the facts of this case. So we believe the district court properly concluded that the state court decisions were an unreasonable application of Strickland and an unreasonable determination of the facts in this case. And we'd ask the court to affirm the detailed district court decision.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Donna Koch for the appellant. One of the glaring difficulties, if I may, with opposing counsel argument, Mr. Hayes has never testified that he did not understand the difference between the two types of defenses. He never testified that the trial counsel, Mr. Cannella, did not have that conversation with him. He had the opportunity at the 3850 evidentiary hearing to present evidence that he did not understand the difference, and he failed to take advantage of that opportunity. So all this record, all we're left with is the unrebutted testimony of trial counsel and speculation according to what was in Mr. Hayes' head one way or the other. A consideration of this February 21st hearing, which everybody during trial was talking about. As a matter of fact, Judge Perry makes a finding during that conversation, and it's quoted in the order on page 26. Judge Perry essentially makes a finding. He says that Mr. Hayes wanted to proceed with, I think he indicates, he wanted a defense that he was not guilty. That was a finding done by the judge who appeared at that hearing on the 21st, just 2 days before this on this colloquy at trial. The other thing regarding the viability of this insanity defense, one cannot simply conclude and say over and over that was his only viable defense without actually giving support. Why was that defense viable? What evidence did they put on at that evidentiary hearing in the way of perhaps a mental health expert who would have said, oh, yes, that was a viable defense? That never happened. And what did happen at the evidentiary hearing, trial counsel specifically testifies that he felt, after consideration of everything, that insanity was a very weak defense. And he gives a specific reason. Well, right in the case of Knowles versus Mirzayan that Your Honor has noted, it states, as explained more fully below, this court has never required defense counsel to pursue every claim or defense, regardless of its merit, viability, or realistic chance for success. At the end of the day, if trial counsel makes the decision that that is a weak defense, does it actually totally matter whether Mr. Hayes understood the difference in the end result? And as far as the defense that was put on, it was a misidentification defense. And what's important to understand about this misidentification defense, not
counsel,
only...
Counsel, your time has expired.
Okay.
You can wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Not only did they put on the victim who could not, as a matter of fact, misidentified her attacker, the only other eyewitness was the neighbor, Ms. Pineda, who did look out her window. She saw the assault in progress, but she testified specifically at trial that she did not see the attacker's face, and consequently she could not identify her attacker. That misidentification defense was a defense that was worth pressing in this case. This court, the department asked this court to reverse the district court's order granting habeas corpus relief. The state court's decisions here were not contrary to the federal law or involved a misapplication, unreasonable determination of these facts. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you both very much. We really appreciate the help. That is our only case for today, so we are in recess. Thank you very much.